Obviously, what we're doing is touching these kind of deeper layers inside ourselves, and that are personal but connected to much, much more than the personal. And I guess what various things that are emerging as we do this. I mean, one of the things that we're getting, I hope, is the tangible nature of the inner world. It speaks not just through visual imagery, but through all kinds of sensory imagery. What's also noticeably different when you engage in this way is you can really feel the difference between the fantasized places, a bit like you're describing, where the difference between the fantasy, the making it up. One of the big issues around this whole kind of area is, am I making it up? But in practice, there's a profound experiential difference. You feel the difference when you're making something up. It's a construction. It's got a kind of flimsy, ethereal, ephemeral kind of quality, as opposed to the sensory reality, I suppose, of the deeper imaginal. The other thing about the deeper imaginal is that you can't, of course, control it in the same way that you can control fantasy. You can direct your fantasies much more than you can with this material work, which really has its own kind of mysterious life. And sometimes, you know, you come down into the deep place, it's the same. Sometimes it's totally different. Sometimes it's a little bit different. And the key piece is kind of taking it all seriously, trusting the process, and letting yourself be guided by the process step by step. And effectively what we're doing every time we do this is the quest for the grail, is the quest for that mysterious quality that brings life and healing. But in order to do that, we have to traverse the wasteland. We have to come across all the boundaries, all the edges, all the difficult places that stop us connecting to our own deeper life. There's all kinds of voices in there, really, personal voices, ancestral voices, cultural voices. There's many things that tell us to not be sovereign in our own inner world. All the other thing they say to us is that it's, you know, it's private inner world, it's got nothing to do with anything outside. So don't expect, you know, it's all nice to go and have a weekend like this, enjoy yourself, get away from life, but then tomorrow you're back in real life, when none of this has any relevance. Can be given particular credence if you come to a place like Glastonbury, because it can be like, oh well, it's Glastonbury stuff, but now I'm back at home, back in Bristol. I've got to get on with my life and on with my job, and things are different here. In a way, these are all aspects of the wasteland. These are all aspects of the voices inside us that try to keep us away from the potent but uncontrollable, genuinely uncontrollable life within us. The deeper spring of life has its own flow and rhythm. And our choice, really, which goes on anyway, our choice is whether we choose to be consciously aware and participate with it, or in various ways try to resist it. But right in the beginning of the Perlas of Om, where we have the problem being put in a sort of nutshell, in that the problem of Arthur's kingdom is that vision has been lost. And then in a sort of very brief kind of description, we have the squire, the son of Owain, the shaman knight, effectively going on an inner journey into the inner world and bringing back both tangible gains and deathly wounds from that. The challenge, you know, that story challenges us immediately with the tangible nature of the imaginal. Not just the grounded experience of the imaginal, it also says the imaginal is tangible and affects the world that we live in. Now, obviously, there's lots of New Age teaching about that. You know, if any of us have watched that wretched film, The Secret, there's a wonderful bit in The Secret where people familiar with The Secret? It's a New Age teaching, which basically says if you imagine things, you can have them. Right, so it's a sort of New Age consumerism writ large, even to the extent of which they have people who want cars pretending they're driving cars, so they're sitting there like you would, when you're a kid, and you would go, and it was a nice visual. So do that a lot, I was clearly meant to be a driver of cars. I used to have a big thing when I was a kid, I'd pretend to drive a car. Well, they've actually got adults doing that, because that will help them to get a car. And so, how do you win the lottery? I don't know. But I think by magic, I think you have to buy a ticket, and plus you have to buy a lot of tickets. But in the New Age way of doing it, you would imagine yourself winning the lottery and then actually what you do is you write a book about people imagining they win the lottery, and then you sell a lot of copies of that, and that's how you make the money. But, so when I talk about the inner affecting the outer, I of course don't mean that. But I think there is something about that, because the outer actually is also a construction. Our perception of the world that we live in, of course, is not just our construction, which is where how the New Age goes wrong. They treat it as if it's just our construction, and therefore if we just change something in the inner world, we automatically change. In a way, the outer world is the collective dream that we all continue to dream into being. I mean, that is literally true. I mean, the whole financial system of the world that we live on is a collective dream. And, when the whole financial system went into crisis, it was all about imaginary money, imaginary loans being sent at imaginary risks, and the whole imagined system started to collapse on itself. And so then governments print more money in order to generate activity. So this is all literally the financial system of the world depends upon a collective agreement, a systemized collective agreement. But that is literally how it works. But more subtly than that, the outer world is collectively dreamed into existence because it depends on, it's a collective endeavor by all of us based on our perception of ourselves and our perception of the world. So it's an interlocking matrix of visions. And our place in a very real sense, our place in that matrix very much is affected by our sense of sense of self-image and how that self-image interlocks with our world image. In a way, it's why the Kabbalists create an image, this image of the tree that is both both an image of the world that we live in and an image of of our own soul. And there's whole loads of ways of looking at how the places in your own soul are reflected in the outside world and vice versa. In a way, the Tree of Life is a sort of Rosetta Stone that enables us to translate inner and outer experience and find the exact equivalences. And it's in those points of equivalence, those places actually where, if we like, in that vision, where the streams cross, that actually something else can happen. And in a way, the work that we do isn't just an inward work, it involves inward and outward. The work that you just did, James, involved a species of working externally and internally, and inwardly and relationally, as we all are with you and witness it, and as you and I actively engage with it. So we have to work, in some ways you could say that we work both with the embodying the imagination, and we work with the body of the imagination. And in that sense, the world is the body of the imagination. It is that which is generated out of the mystery as a cooperative creation. So, for example, a small Small change I made just for a couple of days right at the end of my stay in Israel. It was only, no, actually it was just for one day, let's not exaggerate. So for one day I changed my place in the world, and I have a taxi journey to Tel Aviv University because I'd cottoned on. So the day before I'd really worked out what the problem was, and in terms of the actual externality of the world. So instead of going into my normal rage at Israeli taxi drivers who don't understand me and never will, when the guy started to argue with me about where we needed to go, I explained to him that actually what the numbering system was. He didn't believe me, but because I explained to him rather than raged at him, he said, well, I don't think you're right, but I will go along with you. That's all I needed to do, I said. And we didn't have a fight. So this is the first time in 14 years I didn't have a fight with a taxi driver. So something changed, because my sense of myself changed, and my sense of relating to the outer world changed. Now that wasn't earth-shattering, and doesn't mean I'm not capable of getting to fight with taxi drivers again. I almost certainly am. But that shift of positioning, that greater sense of presence and freedom, meant that something that's been bugging me for 14 years changed. And it doesn't sound dramatic, but it was huge for me. It was sort of, so I walked into the university to see my group for the first time, not angry and upset. And the whole thing went much better as a result. As a result of that, actually, I had a much better meeting with my, it's held in business with Israelis for all kinds of reasons, which I won't bore you with, but partly because I'd settled something in myself. I had a much better business meeting later that day with my Israeli colleagues, and we worked out something. Because I was about to storm off from Tel Aviv for different reasons, but a similar kind of energy. And because I sort of altered it a bit with the taxi driver, I had a bit more space for what they were saying to me, and could respond from a slightly different space. So these apparently small shifts, if we persist in them, and the key thing with this kind of work is to allow ourselves to persist. To stay with the process. And that means to trust the inner world, in particular that because of this profoundly extroverted world we live in, it is to trust the impulses that arise in the inner world. And for me, I suppose that's, you know, this is very much why I do this work, why I run groups like this, why I read some of these things like the High History. Because it reminds me of, in some ways, of some of the tangles I get into and the possible ways out of that. You know, that beginning of the High History really speaks to me about the powerful beginning of this book, which is quite different from a lot of the other Grail stories. Is it, you've got, you know, this is the established Arthur, who is normally, you know, he's either trying to establish his kingdom in the Malory stories, or he establishes his kingdom, or then he's right into the Moft Arthur when it all goes wrong. This is Arthur in the middle of his life, having kind of gone lazy. And it's not dramatic, but it's much more accurate in some ways, certainly in my own experience what I hope is the middle of my life, I don't know. But it is that place where you get lazy, where you kind of dull out a bit, where you're not paying enough attention to things. And there's very powerful kind of vision then of the squire, of the son of Owain, really speaks and challenges me in a way right at the beginning with the reality of the imaginal. And what that means I have to work with is automatically my distrust and doubt of the imaginal. I mean, that's in a way the dual edge here, really. That's where the sword has always two edges. You know, the sword really represents this energy of intention and will, and it's double-edged. And in a way, you have to be able to work with both edges. So the moment you work with faith, you work with doubt. The moment you work with love, you're also touching hate. And it all comes together at the tip of the sword. it concentrates, the energy of the sword concentrates right at the tip. That's the place of maximum intensity, maximum energy. And the thing about a sword is you have to, you know, you have to hold it steady, you have to know what you're doing. You can't, you have to be present if you're going to hold the sword. So that place of will and intention is a powerful energy. And so the sword's a very helpful image to me, because if you're lazy with a sword and hack around with it, you either hurt yourself or you hurt other people or you break things. It's a very kind of helpful kind of, not just image, but object in that sense. You know, it speaks, it externalizes and makes tangible an inner reality. So what we do with our intentionality, what we do with our will, is significant. Sometimes we sheath the sword, we let our will rest. Other times it's important to the sword unsheathed. But it's very important to have the sword. Now, what happens to Arthur as he, after, you know, he has a very similar journey to the Owain's Squire. He goes off to sing at the chapel's called Saint Augustine's Chapel in the wild, but he conquers the Black Knight because he is sovereign. He is the king. The squire is premature. A squire, it's quite precise, this book. A squire is not yet a knight. The squire had very good intentions, but he's taking on too much. You know, had he been, you know, there's a whole process that knights go through, which involves a vigil and being given their sword and kind of, and having been trained to use the sword. And then you go off on the adventure. You know, what we see happening with in the high history is that the squire immediately goes off, wakes up with a start and goes off in vision in the middle of the night, and isn't really ready. He thinks the king's gone ahead of him. He hasn't checked out. He rushes off, and he puts himself at hazard because he just simply isn't ready yet. So there's something about this, as for a biblical phrase, it's a very male phrase, but we must tarry in Jerusalem until our beards are grown. It's got a male image, but it holds the same idea. We must wait until we are ready, trusting the internal process. But then, when we are ready, we must go. If we don't go, we end up like Arthur, lolling around the house, you know, we sort of depressing everybody and losing vision. But then when we go, we have to go to the chapel. Now, there's other characters in the book, The High History, that are kind of interesting as well. They all really represent aspects of ourselves. One of them is Lancelot. And of the various characters in this book, Lancelot is the one who never does see the Grail, never appears to him. He never comes into contact with the saving vessel, with the kind of the energy of transformation. And this is because of his love affair with Guinevere. Now, you can put a conventional morality on that, but that isn't what the book is about. It really is saying that actually he has, in his sense of Guinevere, he has made her his god. The relationship with Guinevere, in a way, has become his fixation place, his idea fixe. She becomes in a way, she stands for him as the goddess. But she stops him. His image of her stops him from finding the Grail. Stops him from even being accessible to the Grail. Because all the whole story of Lancelot, everything he does for Guinevere. We're a bit in the territory of Tristan and Isolde from in the Wagner thing in the Wasteland. where this powerful, passionate but doomed relationship means that nothing else can get in. It's the exclusivity of this place. It's not that the love between them opens the heart in such a way that the rest of the world can come in. It's an exclusive romanticism where nothing else can get in, nothing else is wanted. In some part of the courtly love thing, the tradition of Dante, you find it this, where his, in a way, his love for Beatrice means that he ends up opening to the whole universe. So it isn't that romantic love is wrong. It isn't that passion is wrong. It's what does it do to us? So if passion really simply remains with a romantic object, and excludes the rest of the world, it destroys. It closes down, it stops. Or that passion can open the heart, even the unrequited, you know, the unrequited love of Dante for Beatrice means that he ends up embracing the whole universe as he knew it. That power of longing opens him enormously, extraordinarily. Or it can, like Lancelot, mean that everything you do is about the beloved. The simple human beloved, not about the beloved to it that is the divine, that therefore can include other things of the being. So Lancelot rackets around the book doing all kinds of good things, right? Powerful, ethical, important things. He is, whole point about Lancelot, he is a good knight, he is a protective, helpful kind, but there is a depth that he cannot go to, that he can never be available to, because everything he does is in Guinevere's service. In some of the other stories, the real development of Lancelot happens after the death of Guinevere. And there's a poem I'll read you in a moment. It's a Charles Williams understanding of Lancelot after the death, which that's the moment. It's only then that Lancelot starts to develop in a deeper sense. The other figure we have in the book is a figure called Gawain, because a figure out of Welsh myth, the name in Welsh is Gwalch Mai, which means the Hawk of May. He's a figure in quite a lot of the Arthurian romances. He's particularly Gawain in the wonderful Middle English poem called Gawain and the Green Knight, which is a profound study of opposites. And Gawain probably is one of the really original Grail winners in the Grail stories, because he's a figure that connects to the you know, the pentagram figure you see a lot in witchcraft and around Glastonbury. Well, one of the very early places in English literature that you find the pentagram is in the story of Gawain and the Green Knight. There's a profound meditation upon the pentagram as the symbol of a human being, and it is described as the endless knot that ties everything together, in particular that ties together the five senses of the human being, that ties the five senses into the wounds of Christ and the sorrows of Mary. So so it's a very profound meditation on the personal, the body, the senses, and the deeply collective. And Gawain in this story is all about the experience of opposites. And there's a great bit right in the beginning of it where he encounters Judas Maccabeus, sort of biblical things. It's like bizarre. He's traveling out of Camelot, and he meets this great Judas Maccabeus, is a great figure out of Jewish history, great warrior, and he also has this tradition that he was connected with hawking. He always did a hawk. And it's presumably why he's been pulled into the story of Gawain. It's like totally surreal. Well, I was out one day and I met Judas Maccabeus with his orc, and he defeats Judas Maccabeus, and he's given the red shield with a golden hawk, which is the shield of Gawain. So there's a strange connection with this figure out of ancient Jewish history. And there's a whole in the high history of the Holy Grail, the stories really about these repeated journeys which involve passing through aspects of the wasteland, coming at length to the garden, and then experiencing the Grail. But what is experienced in the Grail is not some vanishing out of the world. What is experienced is the mass of the Grail. It is this act of collective remembrance. So we're back with this act of remembrance. We're back with the Hebrew Zachor, the return to the garden. And that return to the garden is about the bringing of everything together. It's bringing the personal dead, the collective dead, the old dead patterns, painful patterns of our own life, into relationship with something that represents the source of life, that represents these potent, these things that are called the Grail hallows. To hallow is to make whole. So it's to bring the wounded, dry, dead places into relationship with something that allows flow, that is protean. You can never tell what the Grail is. It keeps on changing its shape. So it can appear in all kinds of things, and we never quite know how it's going to appear. But one particular point is made in this book is that that the chalice shape has been lost from Logres, has been lost from Britain. So this book partly is about the restoration of the sword and the chalice. These are the two tangible objects that have to be found again. Now, Gawain is the person who finds the sword. The good knight Parzival is the figure who in the end, the cup properly appears to and is the guardian of the cup. Although it is Arthur who receives the chalice. The Parzival, in a way, you could say, is the guardian of the chalice. He is the Grail King. But the cup appears to Arthur right towards the end of the book. And that's when the chalice is... What appears is both bells appear and chalices appear simultaneously. Because in what we discover, there are no bells or chalices in all of King Arthur's realm. And this is part of the wasteland that Arthur lives with. You could say, therefore, there is no... You know, bells are... You know, if you ring a bell... The quality of a bell is to bring us to a sense of presence. The bells call you to church, they call you to the Eucharistic feast, they call you to the place of remembrance. Without the chalice, there is no container for the feast. Because the chalice holds the, in a way you could say, the chalice holds the living, redeeming blood. It holds the quality of the true rivers that we were working with earlier. It enables us to hold those qualities so that they can be digested and nourish us. Now, in the Grail stories, people become aware of the mysterious chapels and by the tolling of a bell. So you don't know that there is the possibility of the place of remembrance. Unless you hear the bell, unless you're woken up into presence. So, and in that moment you find the possibility, as you become present, any place then is the Grail Chapel. Because in any place we are present with the possibility of healing and the possibility of embracing the wasteland. If we can hold things in a certain way. What the book also says, but the first thing that has to be found is the sword. The chalice doesn't appear until the sword is first found. And the sword is this powerful thing. This is the sword that has beheaded John the Baptist. So this is, you know, you might think this is not a great sword. So this is a sword has a destructive energy. It has killed a great prophet. And yet it is simultaneously the holy sword. This is, in a way you could say, it is the sword of Salome. It is the sword wielded through Salome to behead John the Baptist. So to find that sword is automatically to confront old pain, old injustice. One of the things that, one of the questions as we go looking for the sword of our own will, the sword of our own intentionality, is inevitably we encounter what has happened to that will, what has happened to the sword. How has it been misused in our lives? Who has taken our sword? Where is our sword? You know, these are the grail, these actually are the grail questions. The whole thing about the grail is that you have to ask questions. The grail does not manifest unless you ask questions. Doesn't mean you have to ask literal questions, but you have to have that energy of inquiry. The other thing that throngs this, that story is there are lots of opponents. You have the Black Knight, there's the Dragon Knight, there's the King of Castle Mortal. There's a figure called the Black Hermit, who is this, because it was the ultimate enemy that Percival has to overcome. So instantly you take hold of the sword, you potentize the experience, but instantly you are challenged. It again is this image of James, a king is a free man is a king. Once you assume kingship, the sovereignty of your own life, you are challenged in your sovereignty. That's what happens to Arthur. He draws the sword from the stone. He is immediately embattled. He is immediately challenged. And that happens immediately you draw the sword. But once you draw the sword, you are then on track. There is then the serious possibility of encountering the grail, of encountering the chalice, of being fed directly by the chalice. Now to hold the sword, you have to be focused, you have to be clear, you have to be very present. You have to establish yourself in that place of the sun. You have to walk the garden and touch it clearly, touch things to make new life come, to be focused. Where does the new life come? Where I touch it, that's where the new life comes. You use your intention to do that. You grow your garden. You maybe use your sword to clear some parts of the garden, so you use the destructive edge of the sword to kill some parts of the garden. Other parts of the garden you bless and you give life to. But then, if you wish to experience the grail, you have to come to the place of the art, the place of mystery. You have to place yourself in the position of being the chalice, of being empty. You have to enter then into a different place of vulnerability. And in a way, you see, if we could paraphrase the adventures of the different knights who are in that book, where Arthur has to believe and sustain vision and keep himself present. Gawain has to learn the ways of the sword, has to learn the ways of working with opposites. He encounters an extraordinary knight called the Knight Coward. It's like a real Monty Python figure. You know in Monty Python where the guy runs away and then Blondel follows him to the thing singing, he ran away, he buggered off, he's a really coward. Well, in this book, Gawain, who's the great knight, encounters this totally cowardly knight who runs away all the time. And Gawain keeps pontificating about knightly virtues and he's saying, well, I'm never going to do that, I just run away, me. Why don't we let's just run away? And Gawain will say things like, yeah, let's challenge the robbers. And like, no, let's run away. And so that knightly, it's very powerful, this book, because it's very different from a lot of the other Grail books, because that knightly thing has been completely deconstructed by the coward knight, sometimes called the motley knight, the fool knight. So Gawain has to really work with the opposites, just in the way that we've been working with the opposites. You have to really kind of hold the tension of those places. You have to learn the ways of the sword, to learn the way of focus, and the fact that to focus, you have to really focus, you have to hold the opposites. You have to really align your will and learn the ways of your will, learn what's happened to it, learn to, if you like, revive your will from wherever it is, because the sword often is embedded in the sword, quite stuck. It's not a free, fluid, creative intentionality. Sometimes it can move a bit, you know, because it's got a bit of wiggle room. But actually what we have to learn is to draw the sword from the stone. So then our will is freed. Our will is present. It has the possibility for creation and destruction in our life. And so we have to learn to handle that, learn what happens when we align ourselves with some possibilities. Every possibility. It's somebody, actually, has my friend Penny, who was telling me, we were talking the other day, and she reminded me of a saying of my own teacher, was that he talks about every birth of the Christ includes the death, the massacre of the innocents. Because every choice that you make and every new thing you bring into being involves the killing of other possibilities. So it's to really somewhere take responsibility, not in a heavy way, but in a direct way for our own free and creative will, our own capacity to create and destroy. And that, in a way, is the task of Gawain. You know, he is the knight of opposite. He is the hawk, you know, the hawk that flies high and plunges low. The hawk whose wings go out to the horizon. He has to integrate the opposites in himself. Lancelot has to free himself from fixation. He has to free himself from obsession. He has to, in a way, although his obsession sounds noble, you know, his love of the courtly lady, it completely stops him. He doesn't go anywhere near the places the other knights can go. And he doesn't until his object of fixation dies. And because in Lancelot, you could say, he's fixated on that outer place. It's the outer image of, it's the very, where instead of Guinevere for him could have become this inner image that takes him into the sense of presence, that opens his heart, that makes him clear. He could have found her deeply in his inner realm, but instead he remains fixated on the outer Guinevere. And in the various story, in the sort of Malory version of the Mordatha, you know, when she's in trouble, he rides to her rescue, and he's completely blind. He rides into to hurt it because she's about to be burned at the stake. So he rides to free her, but he's so caught up in his concern for her, he kills friends of his, because he sees nobody but Guinevere, and nobody matters to him but Guinevere. So that obsessive fixation, which paralyzes the will, establishes it, focuses it only on one figure, that has to die. So that these places where we look for that kind of satisfaction in the outer world has to die, otherwise we don't ever experience the Grail. It's never possible for us to come into present and then come into the mystery of the empty chalice.
Sounds like Western culture, basically.
Yeah, totally.
It's out there.
Totally.
Once you have an iPhone, it'll be fine.
Totally, totally there. It's absolutely there, right? So that what we're doing here is profoundly countercultural. Where, so it's counter, you know, the whole, if you look at even what happens to inner things, like, you know, practice of psychotherapy. You know, this starts off as a profoundly countercultural thing, Jung and Freud and kind of, and now an established part of Western culture, but thoroughly externalized. Into sort of CBT, into the, you know, completely, you can buy it off the shelf now. It loses all sense of the numinous and the mysterious, gone from it. That's absolutely the thrust of Western culture. What's also the part of Western culture is polarizing. So all these different things, these different knights represent, if you like, completely countercultural energies. You know, so the Arthur figure would say to us, vision is central. If you lose, vision is tangible, not just central, more solid than matter. Vision is more solid than matter. And vision profoundly affects matter. Back with the alchemists and the philosopher's stone, yes? It's the same thing. Gawain would say you have to put, you have to put the opposites together in order to wield the sword. The sword isn't for killing your enemies, it is for including your enemies. That's what a whole sword is. Lancelot has to free himself. Percival, as he is here, Percival in the German, is this mischievous, holy fool, really, profoundly intuitive, who is not a great warrior. He's, you know, Lancelot's the great warrior figure, and Gawain is probably the other great, all three of the others are much better warriors. He just sort of bumbles around doing the right thing, doing the intuitive thing, except that the one thing he does wrong is that he's given advice very 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 early on by his uncle, where he's told that if he meets a woman, he must always kiss her, always take a ring from her, or something else, can't remember, and the other thing he's told is not to ask questions. And so he does. Oh, okay then. And he, one of the very first things he does is he effectively kind of steals a ring and kisses the lady of a knight called Marin the Jealous. Should you meet a knight called Marin the Jealous, it's probably a clue. Don't kiss his missus without making sure Marin's cool about it. And probably he's not, because he actually is called Marin the Jealous. But because, and in a certain sense, what we see Percival doing here is not being true to his deeper nature, following this so-called knightly rules. This is what a good knight should do. I mean, Percival, remember, has been kept in ignorance of the whole world of knights and their things, and has been taught by his mum to really kind of not be ignorant of all these things. So he gets, he has a few rules and gets into terrible trouble by following these rules. But actually what you see happening with him is that he follows eventually he starts to follow his deeper nature and to just respond intuitively to things. And in the end, that's why he becomes the Grail King, because he is the person who can sit in that place of mystery and then just let the mystery speak through him. He, in effect, is the chalice that through which the mystery expresses itself. He, in a way, is the cup. And the one of the images that you're constantly seeing emerging from the cup in this story is you find the Christ child appearing. And it's that quality of the Christ child, that innocence and responsiveness, that in a way is the quality that enables the Grail to manifest. It's that surrender, where we surrender into the cup, we make ourselves the vessel, and we are filled with whatever is good to eat at that time. And what that does, what all of this does, all this complicated stuff, we can come straight back again to the act of remembrance. So when we're at the cenotaph, remembering the dead, we bring the dead to mind, we bring them present. Our intention is to bring the dead present. Our intention is to be the chalice, that be the living chalice that can, the place where, to be the bridge, to be the chalice, which in your vision is very clear, Steve, where your hands come together, you hold the place where the new life can emerge and new nourishment can be given, which comes out of the meeting of the living and the dead. And that's the moment where something new emerges. Something new happens. That's the moment of profound possibility. And it happens in every moment. You know, it's not something we have to come to Glastonbury for or anywhere for. Okay, it's that moment where we're present where we notice our intentionality, where we allow the meeting of opposites, where in a way what we have to do is we have to almost to follow the journey of these nights. We have to let ourselves free ourselves from the fixation of the outer. We have to let ourselves come inward. We have to trust the vision that arises. We have to tolerate the experience of the opposites that appears. We have to come into the presence, the empty presence. And then we have to allow ourselves to be at the service of that presence. In a sense, we could say that's the moment when the grail appears. And we are then the servant, the keeper, and the transmitter of that blessing. And just to end this bit, really, and then we'll just see what anybody else wants to say. I just want to read you a poem by Charles Williams. It's called Taliesin at Lancelot's Mass, and it really is about the grail mass, really, beautifully described. So we have Lancelot saying Mass. And we've got Taliesin, in Charles Williams' poetry. Taliesin is the king's poet. He's the spectator who records. He's the bard of King Arthur, in a way, and who records everything that happens. And this happens after the end of the Mort d'Arthur, the end of the Great Table. The whole story is ended. This is when it happens. So Taliesin at Lancelot's Mass. I came to his altar when dew was bright on the grass. He was not sworn of the priesthood, began the Mass. The altar was an ancient stone laid upon stones, Carbonek's arch, Camelot's wall, frame of boar's bones. In armour before the earthen footpace he stood. On his surcoat the lions of his house, dappled with blood, rampant, regardant. But he wore no helm or sword, and his hands were bare as laterans to the work of our Lord. In the ritual before the altar, Lancelot began to pass. All the dead lords of the table were drawn from their graves to the Mass. They stood inward turned, as shields on a white rushing deck, between Nimue of Brocélande and Elaine of Carbonek. In Blanchefleur's cell at Almesbury, the Queen Guinevere felt the past exposed, and the details sharp and dear, draw at the pang in the breast, till, rich and reconciled, the mystical milk rose in the mother of Logres's child. Out of the Queen's substitution, the wounded and dead king entered into salvation to serve the holy thing, singly seen in the Mass, owning the double crown, going to the altar Peles, and Arthur moving down. Lancelot and Arthur wove the web, the sky opened on moon and sun. Between them, light traced on high, the unseen knight of terror stood as a friend. Invisible things, invisible, waited the end. Lancelot came to the cannon. My household stood around me, bearers of the banners, bounteous in blood, each at the earthen footpace ordained to be blessed and to bless, each than I and than all, lordlier and less. Then at the altar we sang in our office the cycle of names, of their great attributed virtues, the festival of flames, fell from new sky to new earth, the light in bands of bitter glory renewed the imperial lands. Then the Byzantine ritual, the epiclesis, began, and their voices in ours invoked the making of man. Petal on petal floated out of the blossom of the host, and always the Theotokos conceived by the Holy Ghost. We exposed, we exalted the unity, prismed shone, web, paths, points. As it was done, the Antipodean zones were retrieved round a white rushing deck, and the acts of the emperor took zenith from Caucasia to Carbonek. Over the altar, flame of anatomized fire, the high prince stood, gyre in burning gyre, day level before him, night massed behind, the table ascended, the glories intertwined. The table ascended, each in turn lordliest and least, slave and squire, woman and wizard, poet and priest, interchanged adoration, interdispersed prayer. The ruddy pillar of the infant was the passage of the porphyry stair. That which had been Taliesin rose in the rood, in the house of Galahad over the altar he stood, manacled by the web, in the web made free. There was no capable joy for the song, no capable song for the joy in me. Joy to new joy, piercing from paths forgone, that which had been Taliesin made joy to a joy unknown, manifest joy speeding in a joy unmanifest. Lancelot's voice below sang Ita missa est. Fast to the Byzantine harbour gather the salvage sails. That which was once Taliesin rides to the barrows of Wales, up the vales of the Wye. If skill be of work or of will, in the dispersed homes of the household, let the company pray for it still.